Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
My first job, I was in-house at a fur company with this old pro copywriter, Greek, named Teddy. And Teddy told me the most important idea in advertising is new. It creates an itch. You simply put your product in there as a kind of calamine lotion. But he also talked about a deeper bond with the product. Nostalgia. It's delicate, but potent.
That's John Hamm from AMC's hit series, Mad Men. As we enter a new decade, we thought it might be fun to revisit the show that covered one of the most dynamic decades of American history, the 1960s. 5 years ago, Matthew Weiner wrapped his meticulously detailed advertising epic after 7 seasons on the air. Matt Zoller-Seitz is editor-at-large of RogerEbert.com and a TV critic for Vulture and New York Magazine. He's also the author of Mad Men Carousel, The Complete Critical Companion. We welcomed Matt and his frequent collaborator, Rolling Stone's chief television critic, Alan Sepinwall, to talk about the impact of Mad Men and discuss their favorite moments from the show. Matt says that the beginning and end to his appreciation of the show is how layered its storytelling is.
It operates simultaneously on at least 5 levels at the same time in pretty much every scene. You know, on level one is plot and character, what happens next and who it happens to. Level two is the character's relationship to their own psychology and how much are they aware of the construction of their character. And if so, what do they do about it? And are they acting on good information or bad information? And then level three is their relationship to their environment, specifically New York City, but also increasingly Los Angeles and the United States as a whole. And level four is their relationship to American history, and it covers a time span of 1960 to 1971, and that was a period of enormous societal change, not just within the white upper middle class, which is the main sort of demographic segment represented on the show, but also within all of these social groups that occasionally intrude on that sphere and cause them to reevaluate themselves. And then the fifth and final level is time. is the show is looking at the cycles of personal history and how they repeat, and also cycles of history and how they repeat, and the flashbacks of Don's childhood in the 1930s, which I came to believe were more his imagining than a representation of what actually happened. You see a lot of the same fears and concerns and aspirations happening in the 1930s that were happening in the 1960s. And then by implication, I guess we're probably dealing with our own version of this stuff. And I think we are.
Well, why are Mad Men's characters so true to life?
I think it's because they do what those characters would do. You know, I think more than almost any other television show I can think of, the psychology of those characters has been thought through on such a deep level that even when they do something that seems out of character, it only takes you a few minutes after thinking about it to realize, yeah, that is in fact the sort of thing that they would do. Like the fact that Peggy, you know, Peggy's character, despite being this really careful, meticulous, driven sort of professional woman, is constantly getting involved in self-destructive affairs with men who are bad for her in some way. You know, and she keeps doing it, and you get to late in the show, and you're like, why is she doing something like this? Hasn't she learned anything? And it's like, yeah, maybe she has on some level, but she's Peggy, so this is what she does. And you see this happen again and again with all the major characters. They keep trying to escape themselves. They keep trying to escape their essence or discover it, and they have varying degrees of success. And a lot of this it has to do with how well they really know themselves. Like, do they really know themselves, or do they just think they do?
Yeah. Yeah, Mad Men's creator Matthew Weiner has said that he's always assumed that people have the same feelings as him, and he's usually right. They just won't admit it. Do you think that that's one of the reasons why the characters are so true to life? Does he just really have a good job of tapping into the human condition?
I think so, but I also think he knows a lot about psychoanalysis and therapy, and that probably helps.
That's right, he does. Good point. Now, there's one moment in Mad Men that really seems to be cited a lot as the moment the show made the leap to greatness. It was the finale of season one, and the episode is called The Wheel. Alan Sepinwall, can you give us a brief synopsis of this episode and give us your take on why it was so powerful?
Well, you know, Don Draper has to give the presentation of a lifetime. They're trying to get the Kodak account. And meanwhile, his relationships have been falling apart. He's been worried that he's going to be outed for, you know, his identity as Dick Whitman. He's thought about running away with Rachel Menken, and just nothing is going right for him. And, you know, he feels like he's on the verge of losing everything, and he's not sure what he cares about. And he goes in and he gives this presentation where he talks about nostalgia being more important than, you know, forward thinking in science fiction. And he starts showing these slides of his family. And it's like doing this presentation, he's really seeing his own life for the first time. And he's realizing, like, how much he's been missing and how little he appreciates this thing. He's a stranger in his own existence. And by the end of it, he's fallen in love with this family that he thought he wanted to run away from. And he goes home and they're not there.
This device isn't a spaceship. It's a time machine. Goes backwards, forwards. It takes us to a place where we ache to go again. It's not called the wheel. It's called the carousel.
Yeah, yeah, and it's also, on a meta level, I think it's beautiful because he's lying. He's getting up there and he's lying. Like, he's presenting these sort of hazy, golden-tinted images and, with a catch in his voice, and he actually moves people to tears in his speech. But this is a family that he alienated through his own increasingly rotten behavior throughout the course of that season. And this is something that Don does time and time again, is he reaches into his own life, often into his own pain, and he extracts something that makes for good advertising, and often he wins awards for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's better in advertising than he is as a person. The version of him that finds its way into the campaigns is always an idealized version, and then we see the rotten reality when he goes home.
Well, of course, what is Don Draper but an advertisement anyway?
Yeah.
You know, like we know from watching the show that that's not who he actually is. This is this thing that he constructed.
Yeah. Would this episode make your top 10 list?
I think it would have to.
Yes. That's when you think about Mad Men, the carousel pitch is one of the three or four scenes that first come to mind and in some ways the most important one to understanding the main character of the show.
Yeah. Do you both have – can you each identify a specific favorite episode?
I mean, it's the suitcase. It has to be the suitcase, at least for me. It's the one where Don and Peggy are in the office together all night. It's, I believe, the middle episode of the series numerically. So it's like the pivot point. And, you know, they've been through so much together, and yet there's still this huge distance between them. And then over the course of this episode, you know, all the barriers get broken down. They speak honestly about a whole lot of stuff. And it doesn't magically repair their relationship. She quits the agency later, and they go through some other things. But, you know, it's the first time that they really start to treat each other as something resembling equals. And the performances by Ham and by Elizabeth Moss are, you know, two of my favorite things in the entire run of the show right there.
You gave me 20 ideas, and I picked out one of them that was a kernel that became that commercial.
So you remember?
I do. It was something about a cowboy. Congratulations.
No, it was something about a kid locked in a closet because his mother was making him wait for the floor to dry, which is basically the whole commercial.
It's a kernel.
Which you changed just enough so that it was yours.
I changed it into a commercial. What, are we going to shoot him in the dark in the closet? That's the way it works. There are no credits on commercials.
But you got the Clio.
It's your job. I give you money, you give me ideas.
And you never say thank you.
That's what the money is for.
How about you, Matt?
Well, I'm going to cheat here a little bit. And
that's
I'm going to say that while I love The Suitcase, I do think it's one of the great episodes. The two episodes that I keep coming back to that to me kind of sum up everything that made this show great, there are two episodes from season three. And one of them is Guy Walks Into an Advertising Agency. Yes. And then the other one is The Grown-Ups.
Okay.
And here's what I love about this. And I talked about, at the top of this interview about all the different layers on which the show operates.
Yeah, five
simultaneously.
Of them.
Okay. So
let's
think about the five levels here. Like, we're building, as soon as we know what year it is, we're thinking this is the season where they kill Kennedy. And how are they going to do it? Because we've seen Kennedy's assassination enacted several times. Now, it's set on the July 4th weekend, 1963, so it's several months in advance. But we have the British owners of the advertising agency come to visit, And what happens to this guy is he gets his foot run over by a lawnmower, which is being driven in a pattern that is identical to the movements of the convertible in Dealey Plaza. And you can actually, I'm serious, I have synced up the footage of Dealey Plaza with the lawnmower sequence, and they even break at exactly the same frame.
Wow.
That's how meticulous this is. And right down to, you know, Joan spending the rest of the episode with blood on her dress, just like Jackie.
Mm-hmm.
And also the way that this is structured like a horror movie, it's like a premonition of the Kennedy assassination that happens months before the actual assassination in the timeline. And then, check this out, we get to the grown-ups. We get to the actual Kennedy assassination episode. And how did they tell us that this is the Kennedy assassination episode? They begin with a scene in an advertising agency. Pete and Harry Crane are sitting at their desk. There's a television. It's a wide shot. There's a television on in the background behind them. And you see the special bulletin logo come up. And we, the audience, know what that means. We know, oh, my God, they killed Kennedy. This is the episode where they deal with that. And what happens is we're looking at that and we're thinking, turn around, turn around. Don't you see what's behind you? Which is the reaction you have when you're watching a horror movie in the theater.
What does it mean?
It's not good.
I know it's not good. There's no future for me here. How did you do it? You made your job up.
I didn't. I looked at other agencies and saw that they had TV departments and wondered why we didn't.
Well, there's no such thing in the accounts field.
I'm gonna die at this desk unnoticed. Do you have any idea what I've done for this company?
What are you doing?
Christ, somebody shot the president.
What?
The president's car was down. They drew their pistols, but the damage was done. The president was knocked over in the back seat of the car, face down.
You're like, turn around. It's right behind you. The horror is right there behind you. Why don't you see it? And so you've essentially got a premonitory nightmare of the Kennedy assassination, and then several episodes later, the actual nightmare.
Yeah, yeah. Matt, you had a Twitter conversation with a critic named Miles McNutt in which he distinguished between theme episodes and episodes with themes. What's the difference?
Well, a theme episode, I think it's just a matter of subtlety. Like a theme episode is the theme of this episode is we don't really listen to each other. And in scene after scene, you see characters failing to listen to each other. You know, it's like it can be more kind of boringly executed, whereas an episode with a theme, it's sort of embedded in the action and embedded in the characters, and maybe it takes you a minute to figure out that there is a theme, you know? Like I think going back to season one, the episode that Alan mentioned, there's a three-episode arc at the end of season one that is very heavy on the election of 1960 and Kennedy versus Nixon and this idea that, you know, those represented two sort of modes of looking at the world and ways of behaving. And all of these characters in the show, including Don and Pete and Roger and Bert and everybody else, they're kind of exemplifying Kennedy or Nixon at various points in the story. And ultimately, this leads to this crisis that Don has over his true identity being revealed.
Don, you should think about how Bert Cooper will react when he hears this information.
What information?
You're not who you say you are. And there's obviously a reason.
Come on.
I would like you to reconsider my qualifications.
You said everything except or else. When you threaten someone in this manner, you should be aware of the fact that if your information is powerful enough to make them do what you want, what else can it make them do?
You see it in Don's character, how he's politically... He's very liberal and he allies himself with the Bohemians and he wants to escape from the rules, but he's also incredibly reactionary in some ways. And it's like he's sort of Kennedy and Nixon at the same time, and I think that becomes even more clear as the show goes on.
Yeah. So episodes, episodes with themes are the majority of Mad Men episodes, right?
I think the really good ones are. Yeah. I mean, there were some times where they maybe hit things a little too hard, a little too obviously. There were a few episodes in season two and season four, particularly, where I felt like they were going at it a little too obviously, but they never did anything on the level of a lot of bad TV that was set in the '60s. Mm-hmm. And I will give them credit. One of the things I thought was great about the show was when they were dealing with major events of the time. It was very rare that they would do an episode that was just about that event and everybody reacting to something on TV. Like they would have a little bit, but they always found a way to mix it up. Like in The Grown-Ups, some people are reacting to the coverage of the Kennedy assassination. There are other characters who seem completely unaffected by it, and there are other characters who don't even know that it happened until after the fact.
Yeah. So how much of the appeal of Mad Men has to do with nostalgia? Alan, what do you think?
I don't know that it's nostalgia necessarily, although mm-hmm. certainly there were people who were like, wow, like these guys look cool. These outfits look great. You know, look how much, you know, January Jones looks like Grace Kelly, all of these things. But I think it's less about the period than it is about the specificity of it. And, you know, there's certainly stories that have been told about Matthew Weiner that make it sound like obsessive, bordering on like maniacal about getting all of these details correct. But you can kind of feel it when you watch it. It feels like, you know, this world that you have, you know, time traveled back to, and you feel like you're immersed in it. And one of the things I always admired about the show is it almost never winked at the conventions of the period. Mm. Like early on, everyone kind of laughed at how much the characters were smoking mm-hmm. and things like that. But that was just sort of the show itself wasn't commenting on it. It was just a matter of fact about it. And the deeper in you got, the less the sense there was of that, because you were accustomed to the smoking, to the sexism, to the racism, to all of these things that people at the time would take for granted and the show treated as taken for granted. And that's why it was so potent.
They also mostly avoided the tendency of a lot of historical fiction to give you one or more characters who represented the quote-unquote modern perspective.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's something that's always that always drove me crazy. I'd go to see a movie, whether it's set in the 1940s or the 14th century, they'd have a character who represented basically a 21st century liberal, college-educated point of view on the period. And their whole point of the character like that is to stand there with their arms folded, disapproving of everybody else in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it always rang really false to me, and just felt like pandering to the audience. And I think it's a much more honest thing to do, to try to construct a world that feels true based on what you know about the period and let people decide how they feel about that.
Yeah. So final question for both of you. What do you think is Mad Men's legacy, and how do you see the influence of it on television today?
I don't know. I don't think there's a lot of shows that are trying to be Mad Men anymore. Do you, Alan?
There aren't. I mean, you could look at Mad Men as the obvious successor to The Sopranos, both because Weiner worked on both shows, but also because it was telling the same kind of really layered storytelling and, you know, treating each episode as its own short story. You don't get a lot of that now. It's very, like, intensely serialized. You know, your producers say things like, you know, I'm making a 10-hour movie, which is not a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's an inferiority complex about movies, I think.
You know, I used to say, you know, when I was recapping the show, I always said, like, this is my favorite show to write about. It wasn't always necessarily my favorite show, but it was my favorite show to write about because there was so much to unpack, so many levels on which everything took place, and there's barely been anything in the year since it ended that has given me quite the same level of joy when it comes time to do any kind of episodic recapping.
Matt Zoller-Seitz is editor-at-large of RogerEbert.com and a TV critic for Vulture and New York Magazine. He's also the author of Mad Men Carousel, The Complete Critical Companion. Alan Sepinwall is Rolling Stone's chief TV critic. You can find out more about Matt, Alan, and Mad Men at WPR.org/beta.
The covers that I like the most are the ones where the artist is really filtering what they love about the original song through their own performance and sensibility.
Music blogger Joshua Farber talks about cover versions in our latest rock and roll thought experiment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.